Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Foate, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Sarah Davidson, who reads from and discusses her new book, Leap, What Will We Do With the Rest of Our Lives?, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, Elizabeth Berg, Deepak Chopra, Michael Connelly, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. In a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thank you for supporting our events, especially our local author events. And thank you also for supporting independent bookstores. Before we begin this evening, if I could have everyone please silence their cell phones, that would be great. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce Colorado author Sarah Davidson, who will talk about her new book, Leap, What Will We Do With the Rest of Our Lives? In Leap, Sarah writes about her life after 50, when, after years of being a successful journalist and screenwriter, she found herself out of work, out of a long-time relationship, and with an empty nest, which is really a common story, I'm sure, for all of us. Now, what do you do? So Sarah talked with many people who found themselves in the same boat. People from Carly Simon to the model Iman to teachers, business people, and people like you and me. She interviewed these people and found out some key things and wrote this wonderful book so that anyone in this particular situation can read and have hope for a future full of possibilities. Sarah Davidson is a best-selling author of Cowboy, Real Property, and Loose Change. She was also the co-executive producer of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman and is a contributing editor of O, the Oprah magazine, as well as many other publications. She lives in Boulder. Please welcome Sarah Davidson.
Thank you so much for coming out on a Friday night. I want to tell you the story behind this book because it very nearly died on the vine. It grew out of a time in my life which I call the narrows. When I was in my 50s, I went through this period, and it went on forever, it seemed, years, when I felt like I was being stripped of my identity and my worth. I was rejected everywhere I went. The doors were closing. And you feel like when you're in the narrows, you feel like you're being beaten up and tossed around and everything seems to collapse at once. It's dark. You're depressed. You get hopeless. And you don't know when you're going to get out of this tunnel or if you're going to get out and what it's going to look like when you do. For me, three things happened at once. After 24 years of working in television and putting on hit shows, suddenly I couldn't find a job. At the same time, my partner, a cowboy artisan that I had hoped to spend the rest of my days with, rode off abruptly, and my two children were in college. maybe there's a child I don't know about somewhere out there. And so suddenly, for the first time in my life, I'm sitting in my house with no work to do, no kids, wondering, what am I supposed to do for the next 30 years? I was only 55. And I thought, well, I'll go back to journalism. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was a reporter for all kinds of magazines. I love reporting. So I went back to those same magazines, but the personnel had changed completely. They didn't remember me, know me. They weren't interested in any of the stories I tried to sell them. And finally, I got a job with a very prestigious magazine, and they reluctantly gave me the okay to go ahead with a story. And I spent 2 months on this story, researching it, writing it, and when I finished it, I really felt it was powerful. And I turned it in, and a week later, I got a call from the editor, and he said, "I've got bad news. We're killing your piece." And I can't really tell you why, but I think our editor doesn't like you. And I said, he doesn't know me. I've never met him. And he said, well, he thinks you're kind of a lightweight Village Voice type. And I said, I never wrote for the Village Voice. And my editor said, I'm sorry, but I don't think it's going to be fruitful for you to submit any other ideas here. So I went for a walk, and I felt humiliated. Not only were they rejecting this piece, they were rejecting me. They were closing the door forever. And I thought, the danger with this kind of rejection is that you start to believe that what they're saying may be true, that you're over the hill, that you don't have it anymore, that nobody wants to hear from you, and you might as well go crawl in a hole and disappear. This is what the Buddhists call the second arrow. The first arrow is the bad thing that happens to you. The second arrow is what you do to yourself because of that bad thing that happened. And in my case, I would lie in bed at night just thrashing myself. I felt like I'd failed at everything. I'd failed at work, failed with my kids who really didn't want to have much to do with me at this time. And I'd failed at love. My life was a total hash. And I thought, I need a new vocation. Nobody wants to pay me to write anything. I need something. I mean, a lot, you know, when you're looking at 30 years ahead and wondering what are they going to be filled with, it's very easy to fill them with, it's fill every day with busyness, with errands, with all kinds of things. The days just get filled up. But I think most of us want something more than just that kind of busyness. We want some kind of fire at the center of our lives, something that makes us feel alive and that being here matters and that we're engaged and with all the essential issues and of the day and connected to other people. So I thought, okay, I need a new vocation. What? All I'd ever done was write, but I'm very interested in health and healing. I love children. And so I tried volunteering. I went to India and I taught English to orphans of low caste. And I volunteered in hospice here in Boulder. And I taught at CU for a semester. And they were all valuable experiences, but I never had the sense that I was running with the current, doing what I'm meant to do. You know how it is when you're doing something and it's nice and, you know, it's a good thing and it's rewarding, but you just don't have the feeling that this is my spot where I'm meant to be. So I was just floundering, but I noticed when I looked around that I wasn't alone. There were lots of other people going through similar transitions to what I was going through. And I started doing interviews. And I interviewed people who were famous, people who were not famous, people who lived in the city, lived in the country, all over the United States. I interviewed more than 200 people who were grappling with this question, what do we do with the next part of life? And what I saw was that everyone goes through the narrows. Everyone goes through this kind of stripping at some point. And if you don't do it voluntarily, which I certainly didn't, I did it kicking and screaming. If you don't do it voluntarily, the world or your body is going to force you to. You're going to have to shift gears into the next phase of life. But the good news is every single person that I talked to found a way out. And they all found a different way out. There was no one path through the narrows. Everybody had to kind of find their own way. There's no blueprint, no guide that can show you do this, this, and this. So at this point, I thought I should do what I've often done in the past, which is turn what I'm interested in into a book. You know, Berry Gordy, who started Motown Records, said, I always admire somebody who can turn pain into money. And I wrote a proposal for a book based on what is this generation going to do with the extra 30 years that didn't exist in previous generations. And then I found that the publishing world has changed. So I had been out of publishing for about 8-10 years. When I started out as a reporter in my 20s and 30s for magazines, and I wanted to write a book, I would call up an editor I'd met or who sent me a letter saying, if you ever want to do a book, let me know. We'd go have lunch. I'd tell him what I wanted to do, and he'd say, great, let's do it. Doesn't happen that way anymore. I found I had to write a proposal, and the proposal almost takes as much time as writing the book itself. And the key thing about the proposal is you have to describe the market. It's not about what your ideas are or how well you write. It's about who's going to buy this book. So I finished the proposal, and we sent it around, and there was general disinterest. A lot of the publishers said, well, we found that boomers only buy, on the average, 2 books a year, and we don't think this is going to be one of them. But finally, I sold the book to Random House for what was really a pittance compared to what I had gotten in the past, but it would at least... It allowed me to call up just about anybody I wanted and say, I'm working on a book for Random House. I'd like to come and interview you. And most of them agreed, whereas if I just called up and said, I'm Sarah Davidson, I'm interested in this subject, can I talk to you? They would have said, I'm very busy. And I spent 2 years interviewing and researching and traveling. And I have to tell you, those were the 2 of the most exciting, fulfilling years of my life. I learned from every person I interviewed, I learned something. I loved the process. And then, I spent another 2 years writing it. And for me, as I said, I learned something from everybody. My attitude changed, my vision changed, my perspective changed. But the biggest shift happened after I had dinner with a high school teacher in Brooklyn who said to me, I told him I was still floundering. I was still trying to figure out what my vocation, what my new role was going to be after I finished this book, because I figure when I finish this book, then what am I going to do? I still need to know what the next, what the next phase my job is going to be. And he asked me a question, and I'd like to invite all of you, when I tell you this question, to listen to what comes up immediately. And the question was, if you knew that the world was going to end in 2 days, what would you do? And without hesitating, I said, take notes. Because I'm a reporter. I'm a writer. If the world is ending, I want to cover that story. That's the story of my life. The biggest story I'll ever write about. And maybe I'll put it in a tube and somebody in space will find it someday. But that's what makes me feel most alive and excited, is reporting and writing. So I saw I had a vocation. I just didn't have anybody who wanted to pay me to do it outside of this book. And the shift that I had to make, and I think that a lot of us have to make at this time of life, is from, for me, creative work was what I needed to do and wanted to do. And I had to make the shift from creating for a purpose, in this case, to get published, to get money, to get recognized, to get feedback, to creating for the sheer joy and challenge of the undertaking. Because even if nobody buys the book or critics say it stinks, they can't take away those wonderful 3 to 4 years I had writing it. Nothing can take that away, and that's the reason to do it, for the pleasure and the joy and the aliveness of doing the task. That's the only reason to do anything in life, but especially at this time of life. It really is about what makes you feel most alive, what is going to really satisfy the deepest part of you. So when I sat down to write it, this was actually the toughest book I've written. This was my 6th book, and what made it so hard is that it was kind of like a fish with feathers. It was a memoir. It was my own story about trying to find answers to the questions I was grappling with. And it was also a big survey. And in the first draft, it was all just a bunch of little stories that didn't hang together. And I had to figure out what was going to make you want to turn the pages, what was going to be the through line that would hook you. And of course, they always say in junior high, whenever the teacher asks a question, and if you don't know it, the best answer is myself. I had to be the through line, my search and what I found and what I was struggling with. And when I finished the book, to my satisfaction, that had always been my goal when I started it, that I wanted to complete a book that I would be satisfied with. And it took me 5 drafts to get there, but when I did get there, I turned it in, and it went into the assembly line to be published. And about 4 months before it was going to be published, I went to New York, and my agent and I asked for a meeting with all the heads of departments at Random House. And we called this meeting, and we went in, and we said, okay, we'd love to know, what is your marketing plan for the book, for Leap? And there was silence in the room. And finally, the publisher said, well, we're going to send it out for reviews and hope we get good reviews and word of mouth, and we'll try to get some national publicity, but we're not going to do a tour, we're not going to send you anywhere, and we're not going to take out any ads. And I said, how many copies are you planning to print? And they hemmed and hawed, and then he said, I think 9,000. Now, I have to tell you, 9,000 copies is like not being published at all. My worst-selling book sold 30,000 copies, and the best, Loose Change, sold over a million. And suddenly, this book is going to sell, they're going to only print 9,000 copies? And they said to me, well, you know, the chains, thank God we are not at a chain right now. Thank God for the independent bookstores. The chains, we went to them and they didn't buy it. They didn't order it. So we don't have a lot of orders. Now, I did a little research and I found out the way this works is every season, each publisher puts together a catalog of the books they're going to publish that season. And then they pick one or two that they're really going to push and put a lot of money into. So when the representative from the publisher goes to the buyer at the chain, and we won't even mention the names of the chains, you know who they are. And he says, here's our two big books this season, and we want you to take 50,000 copies. And that they negotiate, and they, you know, the buyer at the chain agrees to buy so many copies. And then he flips through the catalog quickly, like flipping through a deck of cards. And if anything stands out, he orders a few copies. Otherwise, he doesn't order many of those books. So I was in the catalog shuffle. And when they told me, they said, you know, the buyers from the chains, they're all young, and they don't get this book. And I said, that's because you didn't sell it to them. You didn't tell them what the audience is. You didn't tell them. I mean, duh, there are... how many boomers out there, how many people in our age group who are all going to have to go through this stage? But they were absolutely fixed. Once they decide what they're doing, you can't move them. Now, a lot of people at this point would just give up and go, you know, lick their wounds and move on. But I decided I had to demonstrate to them that there was a market, that there was an audience. So I set up a web campaign on my website, which I invite you to visit, www.sarahdavidson.com, no H. And I sent out e-newsletters. Some of you I know have been receiving them. And I sent them out to everybody I'd ever met in my entire life, dentists, doctors, accountants, anybody who had ever handed me a business card got one of these newsletters, every friend I'd ever had starting in kindergarten and brownie troop. I appealed to everybody I knew to help me out, and I said, I asked them to order the book before it was published online, including through the tattered cover, because I needed to show the publisher before PubDate arrived that there was an audience. And I said, if you ever think about wanting to get me a birthday present or any kind of present, buy the book now, pre-order it. And I will be so happy. It will be the best present, and you're covered for the rest of my life. And then I went to the publisher. We managed through this campaign to sell over 2,000 books before the book was even in the stores. So we went back to Random House, and they said, well, that's nice, but unless you get a major excerpt in a major magazine or unless you get on the Oprah Winfrey show, you know, we're not going to do much. We're sticking with our plan. Well, getting on Oprah, as you know, is like winning the lottery. There's just no way to do it, no way to know for sure that you have any chance of it, and your chances are one in a million. But magazines, I had worked in the magazine business most of my life, on and off. And I went to my agent and I said, let's submit it to Time and Newsweek. And my agent said, oh, they don't do book excerpts. And I said, yes, they do. And I made a list of all the books they had excerpted. And she said, well, I don't have any contacts at Time or Newsweek. So I went home and I looked online, and I knew that Newsweek has a section called the Boomer Files. And every once a month they print some big special, usually kind of superficial, but it's about boomers and their interests. And I called up Newsweek and I said, who edits the Boomer Files? And they gave me a name, Alexis Gelber. And then I Googled her and I found out that both she and I had gone to the Columbia School of Journalism, and she was married to the editor of Newsweek. So now I call Newsweek back and I say, I happen to be a contributing editor of Oh, the Oprah magazine, and I use it a lot. And so I called up and said, hi, I'm calling from Oprah magazine. I want to send Alexis Gelber an email. What's her email address? So they give me the address, and I send her a cold email. And I say, I know you by reputation, and maybe you know me. I've written these books, and I have this new book, and I think it would go great in the Boomer Files. 24 hours later, not even, I get an email back from her saying, of course, I'd love to see it. I know your work, and I'd love to see the book. Have your agent send it over. So I sent my agent an email saying, yay, Newsweek wants to see it. So tell her she has to make a decision quickly because we've got other people who are interested as well. And I push send, and at that moment I realize I sent it not to my agent, but back to Alexis Gelber. And I thought, oh my God, I finally got a break, and I just blew it. It's one of those moments when you wish you could roll back the clock and stop the computer, but once the email goes out, there's no getting it back. And I was just in agony. Well, luckily for me, the editor had a sense of humor, and she sent it back to me and said, I think you meant this for somebody else. So we sent her the book, and she, within a week, she emailed me back and said, you know, we'd love to do an excerpt. I think it would work really well. And I was really intrigued by this phrase that you use called the narrows. So I'd like you to write a piece called The Narrows and, you know, take a little bit from the beginning of the book and the middle and the end and kind of give us the whole sweep, but really focus on the narrows. So fine, I'll do anything she asked me to do. So I wrote it, and they ended up doing a 4-page spread. They sent a photographer out to Boulder, took pictures of me in the snow. And they ran, it was a whole big thing. And when it hit the wires, because it went online before Newsweek ever arrived at anybody's home, suddenly I got thousands of emails on my website. And before this, a good day on my website was 5 or 6 emails. Suddenly I'm getting, you know, thousands in 24 hours. And the theme, what everybody said was, thank God, someone has put a name to what I'm going through. Or, I'm sitting on a rock in the narrows. Help, how do I get out of here? Or, I'm only 39 and I'm already in the narrows. Suddenly, the narrows is becoming part of the language. And I look in the book and I realize I only mentioned the word twice. And I look in the index, it's not in the index. So I called Random House and I said, can you get it in the index in the next printing? So they put it in the index. Now the narrows, if in your book the narrows is in the index, is the second printing. If the narrows isn't, it's the first printing. And we changed the name of chapter 2. It had been some other name. We changed it to the narrows. And even still, as a result of all these pre-orders and the publicity and the response and the fact that it hit a nerve, we're now up to about 35,000 copies in print, which is way better than 9,000. But we still have a ways to go, and I still need your support, because to me, this is not about one book. I have this vision. And my vision is I would like to galvanize people to create, both on their own and with other people, new models of what we can do, how we can be in this time. And there are so many examples that I have in the book and that I continue to keep getting. And I just want to tell you about 3 of them, because there's so many different wonderful things. The sky's the limit. I interviewed a man named Ed Wayne. And Ed was from Houston, and he had an oil valve business. And in his 50s, he decided to sell the business because he said, my kids weren't interested in going into it. And I thought, sell it while you're still healthy and you can do something else. So he put it on the market, and he said, the good news was I sold my business in a week. And the bad news was I sold my business. What do I do now? So he was casting around and didn't like the way it felt to have nothing to do. And he'd been an executive, the boss, and suddenly, you know, he's sitting in his house like I was. And he was with a friend one night, and he saw on CNN some footage of refugees from Bosnia being loaded onto trains, crammed into trains, trying to get over the border because it wasn't safe for them to stay where they were. And he turned to his friend and he said, I'm going there. And his friend said, well, like, why? What are you going to do? And he said, I just want to be useful, be helpful. Maybe I'll hand out blankets. Maybe I'll hand out blankets. I don't know. And she says, well, when are you going? And he said, as soon as possible. And the next day he called up the head of the American Refugee Committee and said, I want to go to Bosnia, and you don't have to pay me. And if I do a bad job, you can fire me. So he went to one of the enclaves where all these refugees were gathering. It wasn't even a camp yet. And he started working in it, getting fresh water. And he said, every day, if you didn't make a difference in people's lives, it was because you stayed in bed. There was so much need. And at the end of every day, you know, you just know that people are better off because you've been here. And then he set up a foundation called Bridge of Life, and now he works all over the globe as a kind of a lone humanitarian. And he's gone from making money to spending money in ways that help communities all over the world. Some other friends of mine who were two emergency room doctors retired, and they had been looking forward to it because when you're an ER doctor, you are in 12-hour shifts. Your time isn't your own. You can't plan for anything. You can't sign up for a class because you don't know what your schedule's going to be from week to week. So they were looking forward to retirement, and just after they retired, they'd had four children, and a baby showed up on their doorstep, so to speak. They were called by somebody at the hospital who said, we have a baby here that's supposed to be adopted, and the adoptive parents have dropped out. Would you be temporary foster parents for this baby? It'll a week maybe till we find another adoptive couple. And they said, sure. So they picked up the baby. They stopped at the drugstore. They bought diapers and formula. They went home. And what had happened is that this baby's mother had had syphilis. So adoptive parents looked it up on the internet, and they saw that the baby could develop blindness or deformities, and they didn't want the baby. And every family on the waiting list passed up this baby because the mother had had syphilis. But the doctors knew the baby was fine. The baby had given antibiotics the minute it was born, and it was healthy. And after a month, they've still got the baby with them. And they are 61, and they looked at each other and asked each other, what was the most joyful part of our life? What gave us the most joy? And they said, raising our kids. So why not do that in retirement? We have the space, we have the love, we have the time. So they went to the adoption agency and said, we know we're older than you like, but since nobody else is coming for this baby, would you consider us? And the agency said, well, we would, but, you know, we're expensive. And they said, how expensive are you? And they said, well, $20,000. And you know what? They swallowed hard and paid. They had fallen in love with the baby after a month, and they said, we would have mortgaged our house if we had to do it, second mortgage to get the money to have this baby. And they made arrangements for one of their grown children to take the child if something should happen to them and they can't complete raising the child. And then I met a woman who decided at the age of 50 to become a nun. You know, usually we think of young girls becoming nuns, but there's a whole movement now of people in midlife who are taking a more deep spiritual path and a very, very serious step, kind of a radical step. You know, Tom Hayden, who was the radical activist and was in the California legislature for 18 years, he says, you can be freer at this time than you've been since your 20s. In fact, one of the emails I got after the Newsweek article excerpt came out said, thank you for making me feel part of a creative movement instead of a lone outsider. So I want to inspire you and urge upon you that this is a time for incredible creativity and risk-taking and imagination. I recently, about a month ago, did an interview with Diane Sawyer for a magazine, and she's 61. And I said to her, how do you feel when people say, 60's the new 40? And she said, that's not true. Sorry, 60 is the new 60. And it is much riper and more interesting than 40. So I thought I would read you a brief piece from the beginning of the book, and then we'll have questions and comments and answers. This is from the introduction. What are you doing now? People would ask me. Everywhere I'd go, what are you doing? What are you doing, Sarah? What are you doing now? Oh, different things. If I'd told the truth, I would have said, I'm doing nothing. For the first time since college, I have no work. In Hollywood jargon, I can't get arrested. I can't sell ideas to producers or articles to magazines, and I don't know how I'll earn any money. The phone doesn't ring, and I have to crank myself up to go out and hustle for scraps. And why, dear God, do I have to hustle at this age? It's humiliating. During this same period, my lover of 7 years, a cowboy artist I'd expected to spend the rest of my days with, rides off with no discussion. And my children, who have occupied my first thoughts on waking and my last before falling asleep, are at college. As long as they lived with me, I got up at 7 and made pancakes, drove them to school, soccer, Little League, ballet, music lessons, helped them write their papers and carve pumpkins for Halloween. No more. My kids, my lover, and my livelihood are being yanked away at once, and there's nothing I can do. When I tell this to a friend, Peter Simon, the photographer, he says, oh, honey, you've got money problems and no sex. That's not good. It's not good at all. I can't sleep either. I fall asleep, okay, but I wake up at 2, my feet jackknifing. What am I supposed to do for the next 30 years? I've raised my kids. I've written bestsellers. I've had deep love. Why am I still here? And why are we still here? When I look around, I see that others are going through similar meltdowns and that as a group, we're being stripped of our relevance and our primacy. We did not plan for this. We didn't know that at 55, we might have 30 more years of vigorous health, lust, and a desire to contribute and create. There's a new life stage roughly after 50 and before 80, and we're the ones whose mission it will be to figure out what to do with it. Most of us are addicted to work and have spent more hours at our jobs than any other activity, except for those who've been full-time parents, which is another kind of job. But what happens if we don't work so much or at all? I'm determined to learn what it will take to do the next stage of life well. How do we move ahead with grace and purpose, take risks, laugh and love without condition, be provocative and gain some serenity and understanding of what our time has meant? What I've found is that there will be no single answer, as everyone will go at this differently. We're inventing this on the fly. Tom Hayden believes that we can revive our activism. When you're done with the work you've had to do and you've raised your kids, you can be a freer person than you've been since you were 20. We may have 30 more years to give the system hell. In Eastern cultures, this time of life is traditionally reserved for deep spiritual work. Householders give up their possessions, they drop their names, and they set off to seek truth. What would be the equivalent for us? I don't think walking around Colorado in a robe but with a begging bowl would fly. I don't think people would feel privileged to come out and serve us food. What would be the equivalent for us? Go on a retreat? Join a monastery? Join the Peace Corps? Build a community so we can grow old and wiser along with our friends? Is there a test we can take? Some kind of psycho-affinity aptitude test that will tell us what we should do? Afraid not. Counselors say we should surrender, but what does that mean? Surrender to what? And how is surrender different from giving up and leaving the field in defeat? What happens to love and sensuality and sex? In our youth, the birth control pill was unloosed and the sexual revolution began. Is it an accident that just as we hit prime time, Viagra comes on the market? Some of us are on our third or fourth marriages, and others whom I view with awe are celebrating 30 or 35 years with the same partner. Some announce that they're finished with sex, and others stand with the actress Joan Hotchkiss, who declared at 67 in a one-woman show, "I refuse to go unfucked to my grave." What it comes down to is, what do you really want to do? What will make you feel most alive? That you've used your time well, that your being here has mattered. When I started work on LEAP, I didn't know what, where, or with whom I wanted to be. At the blackest hour, if you'd asked me what I wished for, I might have said, a partner I love, a show on the air or a book on the bestseller list, recognition from my peers, and closeness with my children who are healthy and thriving. In short, I wanted my old life back. But as I followed the lines of research, another view began to emerge. It was as if a curtain fluttered in the wind, and there were glimpses of something moving that would slip from sight and then return. It was like looking for whales on a boat trip that I took with friends, Dr. Andrew Weil and Kathy Goodman, up the Inland Passage of Alaska in 2000. For a week, we were completely cut off from phone and mail, unplugged from the internet. The sea was green and still, and the silence was absolute. Then out of nowhere, we heard a rumble, like a jet plane taking off. A burst of white steam, and a whale broke the surface, arching up and curving back down as if it were a wheel that was revolving. And in seconds, we were in a soup of whales, 60, 70, 80, blowing like jets. Shoo! Shoo! We grabbed binoculars for a shockingly close look. The foaming spout, then the hoary back emerging, and the tail rising last, hanging motionless in air, before slipping into the sea, causing us to moan in pleasure. Then the whales were gone, and we were in limbo, floating somewhere in Frederick Sound and somewhere in our lives, somewhere in our 50s, somewhere near the end of raising our children. Work was up in the air, relationships were shot to hell, and we did not know what we were going home to. So it begins. And that's the beginning of LEAP.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, Elizabeth Berg, Deepak Chopra, Michael Connelly, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 27th, 2007.